Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget the bug spray as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
Okay. This episode is all about mystery lights and earth lights, spook lights, whatever you want to call them. Before I get into the topic of this week's show, March 21st, Canton Palace Theater, the Mysteries and Monsters event at the Canton Palace Theater, which is hosted by the Canton Palace Theater and put on by Small Town Monsters and Mark and myself. And Adrian and anyone else who's part of STM will be there. We're going to have special guests, Shannon LeGros and Lyle Blackburn, who will both be doing talks on. Well, Shannon, I think, is going to do sort of an overarching spooky stories kind of talk, talking about some of the eyewitness testimony she's taken over the years from, you know, people who claim to see weird stuff. And then Lyle is going to be talking more than likely about Bigfoot. I'm assuming that's what it is. Maybe Momo. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I haven't even talked to him. I'm not going to steer him one way or the other. And then there's also, we have a third speaker I'm trying to get locked down who would be strictly UFO related. So you'd kind of hit all three of the major sort of phenomena from Shannon, Lyle, and then who the third speaker is. And then throughout the day, we're going to screen three STM projects. The kickoff for the day is actually going to be Minerva Monster, a 5-year anniversary screening of Minerva Monster, which will be at 11:30. Doors open at 11. Minerva Monster goes live at 11:30, followed by a Q&A with some of the people involved in Minerva Monster, followed by a talk, which will then be followed by a screening of the Flatwoods Monster, A Legacy of Fear, which we've actually managed to never screen at the Canton Palace Theater. And I'm really excited to see that on that huge screen. And then the event will sort of culminate with the premiere of On the Trail of UFOs being seen for probably the first and only time in its entirety on a very large screen, on a big screen. So if you're interested in seeing the series, this is kind of the event for you. Tickets are only $12 for the entire day event. I mean, I think $12 is actually a decent price for a full movie like On the Trail of UFOs. It's going to be over 4 hours long.
Right.
So you're getting all of that plus the Q&A afterward.
It's like a movie marathon plus presentation
conference. Yeah.
And select vendors too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I completely bailed on mentioning that last episode. There are vendors. There's going to be a vendors room upstairs that will include the Wild and Weird West Virginia guys, our friends at the Creep Geeks podcast. I'm going to miss Moth Boys are going to be there. I'll be there. And I'm probably forgetting someone else. I haven't even talked to him yet, but I'd also like to try to get Andrew Smith from the Flatwoods Monster Museum there yet. But I, like I said, I
yeah, mentioned that'd it be to cool.
So
maybe bring some of those Flatwoods vinyl figures.
Yeah, those are like a traveling museum.
Yeah.
And we're going to have props from STM movies, and Bigfoot's going to be there, and some other stuff. So it's going to be a fun thing. We're going to have a whole, it's an all day event. So we are trying to get a food vendor there, who would be there throughout the day selling food. So hopefully we'll get all that locked down. We really want a lot of people there. So come out and support Small Town Monsters.
That's pretty much the only thing like that mm-hmm. in 2020. Is that?
Yeah, that's it. And yeah. In fact, in 2020, I have yet to lock down any events to say yes to any events other than I'm doing Haunted America in Alton, Illinois, which I'm really excited about. Yeah. I get to go back to Alton. So I'm
is that
Troy Taylor's event. So I'll be in Alton for the Haunted America conference, which I don't remember. I think it's June. I don't remember the exact date. But we'll be doing that, and it should be a pretty great event too. But the only other thing I wanted to mention is the Kickstarter for Small Town Monsters launches on February 6th. This is the 5-year anniversary Kickstarter, which is kind of weird because it's actually the 6th Kickstarter we've run. But it's the 5-year anniversary of Small Town Monsters. So we are going to have some. Should we mention real quick the book?
Yeah, sure. Sure.
So So like the big reward this year, obviously there's going to be an amazing Jean St. Jean statue, which I believe is Bellwitch. But we're also going to have a sort of retrospective book. And I don't have any of the technical specs on this book yet, other than it's going to include photos, behind the scenes photos, sketches, artwork from the films. And then, a couple interview segments interspersed throughout, but the big part of it is Mark is writing this sort of like retrospective history on Small Town Monsters, taking you, it's not just movie by movie. It's a, he's also got chapters on Minerva Monster Day. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what else you've got coming out.
Oh man. My mind is awash with Small Town Monster history and minutia right now. So yeah, there are various events that are also mentioned, and the one that after I'm done with the invasion chapter, which I'm working on right now, then I'll be going into our first trip to Maine.
Yeah.
So, not hour by hour, but trying to hit all the high points of these events and why they are significant.
Yeah.
And led one thing to another. And it's a lot of fun, but wow. I mean, to look back and see how compressed the history really is, what we've jammed into 5 years it's mind blowing.
I have
somebody who's lived it, you know, who's been in it.
Yeah.
Just to sit there and look back at it has been incredible.
I did text Mark, his Mothman chapter had me in tears. Partially because of talking about Carolyn Harris's death.
Yeah.
But, that was a really big year. That's the biggest year for STM so far. That sort of informed where we are today and how we've managed to do it. But I'm really excited for people to read this because nothing like this has been done where someone's putting down a sort of comprehensive history of the entire project from the beginning, from day one. And that's what Mark is doing. And he's pulling all this material that I had completely forgotten about, like quotes that I'd forgotten I'd ever said and things that people talk about the history of it, that it had really slipped my mind. And it's been weird for me to go back through chapter by chapter because, I told you the other day, I really don't, it's not that I don't let my, it's not like I'm consciously stopping myself from looking back, but I don't really ever, I just don't do it. I've never sat down and really looked back on the entire span of like technically 6 years. If you really, you know, want to look at it that way, it started filming in 2014 and then was released in 2015. So 2020 is technically the anniversary of the release of Minerva Monster. So there'd be an additional year on top of that. But I mean, even going back before that, there's the book proposal and all that stuff.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's been weird. It's been real weird looking back on all this. Okay. So last week we got into the opening of our Earthlights/Spooklights episode and introduced the phenomenon. And this week we are going to sort of talk about some of the cases that I think we're both interested in. Can you start off though? Is there a specific spot you wanted to talk about the ball lightning thing? Because I am curious about that since you had brought it up.
Yeah,
now I want to know more.
You know, last week I referenced Paul Devereaux's book Earthlights Revelation, and he begins his discussion of mystery lights with talking about ball lightning and how That's been debated by scientists and so forth, but when this was written in the 1980s, he felt as if it was beginning to be grudgingly accepted by scientific community that there is such a thing as ball lightning, but what it is exactly, nobody seems sure. And there's actually this really cool little thing that I want to read that was evidently in the journal Nature, November 1969, where someone named R.C. Jennison saw ball lightning pass through an airplane that he was in.
Wow.
That's pretty wild. Jennison was seated near the front of the passenger cabin of an all-metal airliner on a late-night flight from New York to Washington, March 1963. The aircraft encountered an electrical storm in which it was engulfed in a bright and loud electrical discharge. And then it goes into an actual quote. Some seconds after this, a glowing sphere, a little more than 20 centimeters in diameter, emerged from the pilot's cabin and passed down the aisle of the aircraft approximately 50 centimeters from me. Then he goes into this multi-point scientific observation of what happened. But just that, I mean, those accounts are out there.
Was anyone hit by it?
No. It went down the center aisle.
Oh, wow.
From the cabin to the back of the plane and out. But he saw it. I mean, it's
that's
wild.
Really random.
Yeah. So I guess that what makes me interested in that so much is that this is a couple years ago. We were at a park that's right on the edge of Lake Erie near our home. And the faces north, and there is this large thunderstorm system that was evidently, I mean, it was way in the distance, probably over Canada. And near the top and the back of one particular thunderhead, we saw what evidently was, it was a large enough globe of light that kept circling in and out in almost a insect flight pattern.
No kidding.
Yeah. And this lasted, I mean, this was at least 5 minutes that we could clearly observe this.
You didn't take any photos or anything?
Mm-mm. And it probably was so far.
I don't think it happened then.
Yes, right. And it was so far in the distance that it had to have been fairly large to be visible.
Yeah. What color? Bluish? Or?
Bluish. Yeah. Bluish white. And near, like, that you could see this huge thunderstorm, you know, cumulonimbus cloud, moving slowly eastward, and it was towards the top and the back of that system that this thing was just kind of floating in and out and around in a fairly controlled area. And I can only assume that was
so how
ball lightning.
Can you talk about how ball lightning is formed? I don't know anything about it.
Yeah, I mean,
I thought it was very theoretical.
It is. I think that I'll just go off of what Devereaux says. He says, ball lightning is so termed because it's occasionally seen in association with thundery conditions, is assumed to be electrical in nature, yet displays coherent forms that defy current explanation, and behaves in ways not associated with electrical events as presently understood. In short, it clearly possesses characteristics that elude our present understanding of physics.
Yeah.
So that it's an attempt to describe energy that seems electrical in nature, but why it would be in a ball form. He also goes on to say that it typically, when it's observed close up, it doesn't seem to generate any heat, which would also be something that physics doesn't have an explanation for. But that was our experience. And when people talk about weird things that they've seen, that's my weirdest thing. In addition to the other...
Have we talked about this before? I feel like it's weird if we haven't talked about this because of mine.
Yeah, we have mentioned it in passing, but I don't think I've ever... Because it seemed so natural.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating and sort of wondrous, but there was nothing like, air quotes, supernatural about it. It was just a really cool thing.
No missing time or anything.
Yeah.
So, and I know I've talked about it on the show, but the only thing I've ever really, I mean, other than the Bigfoot throwing rocks at me in the woods in Oklahoma, the only thing I've
and
witnessed.
The Mothman guy from Japanese television.
Yeah, that was fun. the weirdest thing that's happened to me in the woods that I saw with my own eyes was some sort of weird anomalous light. That, like you, I do think what I saw had to have been pretty large because of where I was seeing it, you know, which was across this valley down in Zor, which is actually, we were standing in the location, it would have been real close to where we filmed the interestingly enough, the scene in Momo where Bobo and Cliff and the posse run into the woods and the spook lights show up. That would have been the orbs show up. That would have been real close to where I actually saw some sort of large anomalous light across that valley that is, there's a lake back there and I could see all the way across that lake, and on the other side, maybe like half mile or a mile away, there was it was massive, large, orangish light, amber light, come up out of the woods, rise slowly into the sky, sit there for a second, perfectly round, and then go back down, you know, and it wasn't the moon and all that stuff. So I've talked about it on the show before, and it doesn't really fall into the spook light category. I just know that whatever it was very large, and it, you know, topped the trees, sat there for a second long enough for me to point it out to my dad, and then just slowly lower itself back down, you know, into the forest.
How bright was it, would you say?
It was very bright.
Was it?
It was extremely bright, because I was looking across that valley, and when I saw it, I just couldn't figure out what I was looking at. I said to my dad, like, what am I seeing here? Mm-hmm. And he didn't see it at first. And I was like, I mean, it's way over there. And then it kept coming higher and higher. And, you know, like, you started and I just saw the top of it. And then it gets bigger, and I can see it's this perfectly round amber or yellow, you know, like orange. It was somewhere in there, colored object, kind of in undefinable as far as like, there's no, it was just a ball. Mm-hmm. this weird ball of energy came up out of the woods, hung out in the sky, and then went back down.
I think that's cool. It went back down. I don't know.
That's so weird.
Yeah.
To me. You know, it just sat in the sky for a second long enough for me to see it. And then it just and it was slow, you know, and maybe, you know, maybe it's some sort of balloon. It could have been someone over, because there are people that were, in fact, where we saw it now, I mean, that would have been what, like 2000, I think, were we doing Sasquatch yet when I talked about that on the show? Mm-hmm. I mean, so 2015, maybe it happened. 14, but that whole area has been developed heavily, and would have been developed heavily even then. So whatever it was, it could be something completely mundane, but whatever it was large enough that for it to be, it would have had to be like maybe the size of a hot air balloon.
Wow.
From where I was standing, for me to see that. But that's just guesstimation. More than likely it was aliens coming up out of the coal mines that are over there.
Were they retrieving the
UFO, the Bigfoot? The Bigfoot.
No, the Roswell craft.
It's funny that the Roswell craft, we're getting off, but it's funny that the Roswell craft is tied to two areas that are within like 20 minutes of where I grew up, because the one is the coal mines in Strasbourg that supposedly it was buried in there. And then the other is that it was burned in the Timken,
The blast furnace,
which at the time was supposedly like the hottest furnace in America. That's what I've heard from two different sources. And one of them was a journalist. One of them told me that story. He had heard it from someone. Okay, so, spook lights. Where do you want to really start here? Because we need to talk about some specific cases.
Well, how about maybe the one of the clearly most well-known cases is the Marfa lights. Mm-hmm. And really, the state of Texas seems to be a hotbed for spook lights and the street lights. And this one, I have like a short case study. It's fairly short, but I think that it's fairly descriptive of the type of experiences people have. Mm-hmm. And this is in a reference to an area called Alpine, which is fairly close to Marfa. And again, this is from Earthlight's Revelation by Paul Devereaux. He says, one of the best instances of close observation came as a result of the investigation of two geologists, Pat Kenny and Elwood Wright, who were carrying out geological work in the area in the 1970s. Having heard about the lights, the pair carry out a number of observations between March and June 1973. They went sometimes with companions to the viewing point on the Alpine Road several times during March, and did indeed see flickering lights in the distance, but they simply could not be sure they were not car lights and felt inclined to dismiss all the lights as such. even though they knew that there were no roads in the area where they saw some of the lights. But on March 19th, 20 minutes of viewing was sufficient to convince them this was not the answer. The lights began swinging in an arc like a rocker on a rocking chair and did one complete loop. They appeared to be playing, the geologist commented. The lights were still being observed at a considerable distance, so the following evening, Wright and Kenny decided to try to get a closer look. At least three lights were visible again in the Chinati direction. They drove along a dirt road a few miles onto Mitchell Flat. It was a bright moonlight. They drove without headlights. They stopped and waited. Three range horses near their vehicle suddenly acted in a startled manner. Wright and Kenny, riding in the third person, take up the account. At this precise moment, they observed two lights moving rapidly from the southwest to the northeast, almost at right angles to the road. The first light slowed down near the road, crossed the road less than 1,000 feet in front of their car, and continued to the east where it seemed to merge with or meet a third light, which was brighter and was between their car and the vicinity of the old airbase hangar. It crossed the road only 3 or 4 feet off the ground. The second light, coming from the southwest, followed approximately the same path as the first light, but it seemed to be moving slower. They decided to try to sneak up on it in the car with the lights out and try to intercept it at the same place where the first light had crossed the road, but they could not get close to it. It started veering to the north, and when they got to the point where the first light had crossed the road, the second light was several hundred feet down the road. And it continues on, but then this is the one thing I wanted to make sure to get across. It says, they both had the distinct impression that it knew exactly where they were and that it was just daring them to chase it. The intensity of the light decreased as it slowed down and hovered in one spot.
Almost sentient.
Yeah. The color was approximately the same as an ordinary incandescent household light bulb. It seemed to possess intelligence.
Yeah, see, that comes up a lot, that they possess intelligence, especially with Brown Mountain. Did you have something else?
I thought that case study would be a good place to jump off.
It is.
Because it hits some salient points, and that's one, is that here you have two geologists, trained scientists, and they're both coming up with the impression that this isn't just a random electrical discharge. There seemed to be some sort of control.
Micah told us a story when we were at Brown Mountain, and a lot of the stories do relate to how these things seem to know, you know, seem to almost toy with people or play with people. One of them, though, was that there was someone at the overlook, and they were literally they touched one of these things, supposedly, and when they did, it split into like 1,000 little pieces, like a spark, and then flew off.
Okay,
but they seem to like dance and play with people when they're seen. And I thought that was very interesting. Are you done with Marfa? Can I move on to Brown?
Sure.
Real quick. This is read from the, very, very helpful, website, journalistic empire known as Wikipedia. Brown Mountain lights are a series of ghost lights reported near Brown Mountain in North Carolina. Lights can be seen from Blue Ridge Parkway at mile post 310, Brown Mountain Light Overlook, and 301 Green Mountain Overlook, and from the Brown Mountain Overlook along North Carolina 181 near Jonas Ridge, North Carolina. Real quickly, I'm going to get into this in a second, but the lights can be, where it says the lights can be seen at milepost 310, that's actually the Brown Mountain Light Overlook, not Brown Mountain Overlook. It's literally an overlook that's put there so people can go there and see the Brown Mountain lights. There's a plaque that shows you where to look to see the Brown Mountain lights. I mean, the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
And then it goes into some of the history. The one early account of the lights dates from September 24th, 1913, as reported in the Charlotte Daily Observer. A fisherman claimed to have seen mysterious lights seen just above the horizon every night, red in color with a pronounced circular shape. Soon after this account, a United States Geological Survey employee, D.B. Stewart, studied the area in question and determined the witnesses had mistaken train lights for something more mysterious. So this is all going to be just my firsthand opinion on, or my firsthand account of Brown Mountain and what the area is like. And then some of what I've heard from talking to other people, but this is the only place of the batch we're talking about that I've actually been. And I was just there when was I there? October. I was just there last month or month before last. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what year it is. so Shannon LeGros and I drove up Brown Mountain later, not Brown Mountain itself. I think it would be Green Mountain then. Late at night and parked at that Brown Mountain Lights overlook. One thing I can say about that area that is really weird is that I've been going there my whole life. Since I was 12 years old, I had been going to Marion, North Carolina. When I was a kid, we went to a youth camp down there from the time I was 12 till I was like 21. I was there every year. And then I went back when I was 25 and visited. And like, I have friends, Paul Shirley, who used to do the Ancillary Characters podcast, is his uncle is the pastor at the church. Alan Boone grew up in Marion, so that's his hometown. Mm-hmm. I had somehow never connected the dots on the fact that that is the Brown Mountain Lights. And when I mentioned this to Alan recently, I said I was doing something down in that area, and he's like, is it about the Brown Mountain Lights? And he said everyone knows about it down there, like it's just accepted.
Okay.
Which is really interesting. It's just a part of their local mm-hmm. history. There's nothing weird about it to them. That's just, hey, there's, go see the lights on Brown Mountain.
Did you hear anything about it when you were there at the camp
as a kid?
Yeah.
No.
That's interesting.
Yeah. See, that's the thing. I never connected the two.
Yeah.
But like once I was there, once we drove to, it wasn't until we drove to the area that I realized where we were.
Okay.
We're driving down the road. I was like, I think it's also weird because Hickory, a bunch of my dad's family is from Hickory. We stayed like one exit down from Hickory when we were there. So this is all in a part of the country that I'm very, very familiar with. It's also in a part of the country that is extremely creepy. The backwoods mountainous areas of North Carolina are some of the creepiest places you'll ever go. I don't care what anyone says. It puts some of those backwoods areas of like West Virginia to shame, and it can genuinely feel like you're on another planet. Hmm. And so when we started driving up the mountain, it was about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night.
Some of those roads are no joke. Yeah.
And I mean, you're heading up there, and all of a sudden everything becomes a lot more real in the moment, you know? So like we head up there late at night and get up to the overlook. And I was like, we're going to see something. Like there's no way we're not going to see something, because it was like the perfect weather conditions. And we were up there for maybe like 40 minutes before Micah showed up. And then Micah showed up and it was really cool. We actually had him like on the overlook with Shannon, and he just talked to her and I filmed the whole thing. It was basically them just doing what we're like, just talking. And I just shot the whole thing. We didn't do an interview. It was originally going to be like a kind of talking head interview. Mm-hmm. But I really liked the way it looked, having them up on, and you can see a glimpse of it real quick in the trailer, but mm-hmm. they're up on the hill and then behind them is Brown Mountain. Like you can see it in the distance. And, so we learned a lot about the lights that night. Stories of people seeing them. So the thing that I was curious about is like all the stories I've heard about Brown Mountain Lights is people on that overlook or the one of those overlooks, like people are on the overlooks and they see them. And I was curious if there are sightings of the lights in the woods on Brown Mountain. So like people actually on Brown Mountain, not seeing them, you know, a mile away or whatever, but people actually on Brown Mountain encountering the lights. And apparently there are like people, but also apparently it's very difficult to get up on that mountain, because of road conditions, weather, and the fact that I think it's private property or state property. Mm. And it's very difficult to get on the mm-hmm. mountain. I just interviewed, Greg Cannon from the Creek Geeks podcast. He's seen the lights. But what was interesting about where he saw them is they weren't on Brown Mountain. And that's kind of like what I've discovered in the time since then. They're not relegated to Brown Mountain. Mm. They're in that area. Like they're seen in that general area. In fact, where he told me his sighting happened wasn't where we were looking, which was toward Brown Mountain. It would have been, you're up on a ridge. We're at the overlook. And then obviously there's another valley on the other side that you can look down into. And apparently he was up there with his wife and they were looking for the lights. And some lady or person that was in the area told them, are you looking for the lights? And he said, yes. And she said, well, you're looking in the wrong direction. And they turned around. They were all over the valley behind them.
Oh, wow.
So they're not relegated to just Brown mm-hmm. Mountain. And the other confusing thing about this is we had a really good night vision monocular with us when we were there. But I almost think you stood a better chance seeing them with your naked eye or with the A7S, which I could really crank up the ISO. Mm-hmm. The monocular was throwing me off because if you're looking at Brown Mountain, you're seeing a city on the other side of that mountain, and there's lights all over the valley back there. And it is a good distance from the Brown Mountain lights overlook to Brown Mountain. It's a really good distance. So there were times where we were looking through the monocular and we thought we were seeing the lights. And then you'd realize, oh no, there's also radio towers on top of it. There's antennas in different spots. There's those, the lights that they put for, to warn planes. There's all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. And it gets a little muddied when you're trying to specifically look for the lights from that distance. So if I went back, I'd probably want to try to get closer. We had an opportunity to get closer. Our problem was the weather was getting bad. And then also it was like an hour and 25 minutes to where he originally wanted to meet us, which would have been in Marion. It was mm-hmm. a Marion zip code. But apparently there's far better places to see them than the actual Brown Mountain lights overlook, but it's a really like famous legend down there. And I thought it was cool that it's just kind of accepted as part of the local history.
Did you hear about the big experiment that they did with Brown Mountain?
I probably did. Yeah. I know that there's a group that operates out of the college there.
Oh, okay.
It's called like the Brown Mountain Lights something. And it's run by a skeptic, but they have great footage. Like they've captured amazing footage mm-hmm. of the Brown Mountain Lights.
Yeah. This experiment is, mm-hmm. this was done in 1977.
Oh, no kidding.
And it almost seems like a B-movie science fiction thing because it's a research group called Orion suggested the lights seen were actually a refraction of distant city lights. So what they did is they placed a 500,000 candle power arc light in a town 22 miles east of Brown Mountain and aimed its beam to the west of the mountain where observers were stationed. Its characteristic blue-white beam was seen by the watchers as an orange-red orb, apparently hovering several degrees above Brown Mountain's crest. While it might be fair to wonder how often the good townsfolk direct a 500,000 candle power searchlight into the sky, this experiment probably does help separate the wheat from the chaff in the Brown Mountain problem. Mm-hmm. So there's a way in which those who have tried to explain what's happening are relying on refraction of light.
Yeah.
Or, you know, some sort of arcing that takes place or a reflection.
And I do think that could account for some of the sightings because I mean, just the city lights in the distance twinkle and can confuse the eye when you're looking at the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely think that could be happening. But there's also sighting reports that sort of defy that.
Sure.
Especially if they're taking place on the other side of the overlook where there's nothing.
Yep.
Except forest.
And close up, too.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's many close up encounters mm-hmm. with these things. And again, this is one of the ones we talked about it in the last episode, but this is one of the ones that is tied to like a native legend that it probably isn't an actual Native American legend.
You know, then there's a whole other. I mean, there's tons mm-hmm. when you go looking, including Ozarks.
So, yeah, can we hit on that one real quick? I put that in my list.
Oh, okay.
The Ozark light. It's actually just one light. The Ozark spook light. And the coolest thing about this is that this is Joplin, Missouri. Mm. And the coolest thing about it is if you go to joplinmo.org, which is the official town website, they have an entire section of the website of the official, you know, government website dedicated to the spook light, just called the spook light. I don't know if you went to it.
No.
And it actually gives the history. I mean, it's detailed.
Yeah,
like they go into extensive. A lot of, yeah, really they go into is. A lot of information on the spook light, but just real quick, they give a history of it. Bobbing and bouncing along a dirt road in northeast Oklahoma is the Hornet spook light, a paranormal enigma for more than a century. Described most often as an orange ball of light, the orb travels from east to west along a 4-mile gravel road, long called the Devil's Promenade by area locals. The spook light, often referred to as the Joplin spook light or the Tri-State spook light, is actually in Oklahoma near the small town of Quapaw. However, it is most often seen from the east, which is why it has been attached to the tiny hamlet of Hornet, Missouri, and the larger, better-known town of Joplin. According to the legend, the spook light was first seen by Indians along the infamous Trail of Tears in 1836. However, the first official report occurred in 1881 in a publication called the Ozark Spook Light. The way that's worded is really confusing. I'm assuming it's not the publication that's called the Ozark Spook Light. The ball of fire, described as varying from the size of a baseball to a basketball, dances and spins down the center of the road at high speeds, rising and hovering above the treetops before it retreats and disappears. Others have said it sways from side to side like a lantern being carried by some invisible force. In any event, the orange fire-like ball has reportedly been appearing nightly for well over 100 years. According to locals, the best time to view the spook light is between the hours of 10 p.m. and midnight, and tends to shy away from large groups and loud sounds. Though many paranormal and scientific investigators have studied the light, including the Army Corps of Engineers, no one has been able to provide a conclusive answer as to the origin of the light. Then it goes into a whole thing about like what the explanation, possible explanations for the Hornet spook light might be. But Ozarks. That's a weird area of the country. Oklahoma, Arkansas, Texas. There's something in that area that is uniquely... It just feels unlike any other place, and some of that is because it's really depressing in some of those, those areas.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The thing about that, the Joplin light, that is most fascinating to me is that it's nightly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's nothing that's really said about conditions have to be just so, or it's intermittent. I mean, it's every night.
Yeah.
And in the reports that I saw, you probably saw some as well, I mean, determined people have tried to surround the light, walk alongside of it, and it's winked out and then winked back on, like over in a field.
Yeah.
So once again, there's this sense of
playfulness,
right. Like at least interaction.
Yeah. Yeah. There's the Gurdon light, which is the one that sort of introduced me to this entire subject, which, I'm a huge, Unsolved Mysteries fan. And I had seen the episode that had the Gurdon light. The Gurdon light's interesting because it follows it's Arkansas again. Like a lot of these are down in that area. And if you go to the official website, encyclopediaofarkansas.net, they have an entire section on the Gurdon light. It says the Gurdon light is a mysterious floating light above the railroad tracks near Gurdon in Clark County, which was first sighted during the 1930s. How far, Clark? I feel like Clark County's close to Falk. Am I wrong about that?
I'm not sure.
I feel like Clark County is a neighboring county.
Oh.
Many theories and stories exist to explain the light, including one which connects it to the 1931 murder of William McLean, a railroad worker. The popular local legend drew national attention in December 1994 when NBC's Unsolved Mysteries television show documented the phenomenon. That story involves basically a man who was... not that particular story, but the Gurdon light involves a man whose head was separated. He was separated from his head, and now he searches the railroad tracks, wanders the railroad tracks at night looking for his head. But that's one of my favorites as well.
Yeah, the Gurdon light. We went right through Clark County to get down to Texarkana.
All right. I knew Clark County. Yeah. I think we've maybe been in a newspaper there or something.
Ah.
We probably need to start summing up this spook light thing.
Well, then I will leave some breadcrumbs out there because there is some major cases in Utah. Guess where? Uinta Basin.
Yeah.
And this is, again, this is 70s, 80s. This is well before Skinwalker Ranch was even a thing.
Is it actually tied to the local Native tribes?
Yes.
And
then Yakima, Washington is also another major area that I guess we'll have to do a part two someday.
A trip out to Yakima, where hopefully I'm not dying in a hotel bed. Our one previous trip to Yakima included Mark sitting in a hotel room while I nearly died in the bed from altitude sickness. what I've self-diagnosed as altitude sickness.
Well, that has the distinction of that I double task. So when I went to get you water,
I also
went to take a picture of the camera store where the Patterson-Gimlin footage was evidently developed.
Something with like a a triple or double A baseball. Wasn't there like a baseball thing that you did there?
Oh, yeah. Their front office was in downtown Yakima.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Bought Andy a hat, which okay, he still wears.
That's what it was.
If he's still listening at this point in the episode, it's one of his favorite hats. The Yakima. Oh, no, I blanked.
Uh-oh.
But they're named after an apple, a type of apple that's native to the Yakima Valley.
Or a spook light. Maybe they're named after a spook light.
Yeah. Maybe it's not an apple at all.
You don't know. I wanted to bring it back full circle.
So, spook light with a baseball hat.
Great topic. Like, I really love this subject. And do you want to sum everything up for us? Or any final thoughts on spook light?
Final thoughts? I think, it's like you were hinting at there. There's so many elements to spook lights. I mean, at the surface level, it seems like, it's just a weird light and people can write it off. But there's such a diversity of potential explanations and the fact that they recur and you can see them under the right conditions or in some cases, on a nightly basis.
Mm-hmm.
Not only is that interesting in and of itself, but then all of the folklore that's grown up around it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very rich, and there's tons of it out there when you go looking for it.
Yeah.
And I almost feel like that it's been passed over in some ways, in service of other, more sensational, unexplained phenomena like flying saucers and Bigfoot, Jersey Devils, and so forth. But the spook lights are still with us, which is kind of comforting.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com and is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.